relations in Alberta are strange in general.
Yeah.
Yeah. Huh. You can imagine, can't imagine why.
Yeah, I know. So, that's right, listener. You heard it here first. Buy gold.
Bitcoin.
The New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast, featuring your hosts, Gabe Reinick and Ken Holyoke.
Welcome back to the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast. I'm Gabe Reinick in sunny Southern California, and I'm joined, as I am just about every fortnight, by Ken Holyoke in Lethbridge, Alberta. How are you, Ken?
I'm doing fine, Gabe, and I think the listener should know that the catastrophe and the destruction going on in the background, it is all true, folks. We are in dark times, and so how is it in the field there, Gabe?
Well, so you're going to notice, Ken, I'm actually beside the pool because at any point I may be napalmed and have to dive in just to stop emulating myself. And it's rough, Ken. I mean, I'm not going to lie. You can tell how war-torn this place is right now because I went out last night trying to buy a bottle of Campari, and all they had was Aperol.
Amaro, so it's an Amaro hell, really.
Oh, yeah. This Negroni is essentially undrinkable. I'm hoping that the trucks with the National Guard will be bringing Campari in soon.
One can only hope. They're getting support from Italy, I'm guessing, is the National Guard is coming from Texas, but, you know, the Campari,
yes,
they've some trade deal, I'm sure.
Well, Ken, there is a political ideology that I think was invented in Italy, wasn't there?
it might be being borrowed at this time, you know.
Exactly. Well, if they bring in the Campari on burros, that's fine, too, however, as long as it gets here.
Yeah, from our hearts to Il Duce's.
Exactly right, Ken. And how's Alberta?
Alberta's doing well today. It's been a little bit cool this week. Mm-hmm. We are currently, my children are downstairs. They're not in school because...
Did something happen?
Because we're in Alberta, and so I am in a union, and I am supporting the union that is trying to teach my children. That is
okay,
and that's becoming increasingly challenging in Alberta.
Does that mean you need to let them be feral, or else you'd be crossing a picket line?
They were feral this summer. I didn't actually think they would need to go re-feral this fall, but I'm sure they're getting lots of helpful information from the Nintendo Switch.
Oh, good. It's sort of too bad, Ken. It looked for a while there like you guys might go out on strike at the same time.
Oh, well, you know, I mean, I don't think we're anywhere near job action, but we are also negotiating, which is, I think actually every public sector union in Alberta is negotiating this year. I think it's just for whatever reason, it all lined up. The stars aligned, and it's made for a rather, probably could be a fairly raucous fall in the labor market, in the labor sector, I guess, in Alberta.
Well, Ken, I'm not happy to hear that, and I have to say the phrase "job action" is an ominous one.
There's no job action on our side of things, but yes, the job action is ongoing, and it's actually, it's complicated here, obviously, due to the, if you follow politics here, effectively the politics that you are dealing with in the United States, there's a mirror image going on in a sort of hauntingly similar way.
Oh, interesting. Well, but Ken, we're going to help the listener to escape from thinking about all that today. And we're digging deep literally today, aren't we?
We are going deep. We're at, what is it? Jamiroquai has that great song, "We're Going Deeper Underground."
Yes, we are going deeper underground.
Yeah.
Emmanuel, if you could hum that right now, that'd be great.
Yeah, just do a remix of Jamiroquai's, what is it, like 1994? If you're looking for it, Emmanuel, I'm fairly certain it was on the Godzilla soundtrack.
I assume Emmanuel has the Godzilla soundtrack on vinyl.
Who wouldn't? I mean,
yeah. Exactly. And Ken, but I think, you know, just the far-ranging nature of this conversation so far, and the fact that we are both many time zones from New Brunswick.
Yeah. The listener is familiar with Gabe's ability to travel through time, but also not understand time.
Yes.
And in a conversation yesterday, while we were trying to schedule this conversation, Gabe is trying to convert Pacific time into Atlantic time, and is not carrying any of the ones. And effectively was telling me he'd like to record this podcast at 6 a.m. his time, to which
I was
fairly certain he did not want to do.
And you were correct, Ken. You were absolutely correct. And I appreciate you figuring that out. And I knew we were in great shape when I got a text message from Ken that said, "Can I call you?"
I was kind enough to give you the reminder today that we were recording in 30 minutes Pacific, Mountain, Central, Eastern, and Atlantic time.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. So yes, we might need to switch to, you know, I don't know, Greenwich Mean Time or something.
That would be, yeah. We'll just standardize everything to Greenwich Mean Time. That would be good.
Exactly. Yeah. But right now, if we were to have a show about Greenwich, right, for instance, we would still be called the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast. And that's kind of weird because we could totally have a show about that. Our shows are all over the place.
That's true. Although I'm fairly certain there must be a Greenwich in New Brunswick as well.
Oh, there probably is.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Village of Greenwich.
Could be. Yeah. Is there a joke there?
I just Greenwich Village is the...
Oh, I see.
But in New York.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Gotcha. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess there was a joke, just wasn't very funny. And so Ken, we've perhaps lost the thread here a little bit, but
the thread, so we are talking about threads though, right? And it is threading on an auger that will remove deep soils and discover archaeological sites at quite a depth.
That's right.
And that actually is something that's going on throughout North America, and including in New Brunswick.
Yeah. So even though some things are better left unsaid, invented, that's where we are. And Ken, one of the things that we've been thinking that we should do, Emmanuel would like us to try to increase our listenership.
That's true.
And one of the ways to do that would be to have a title that actually conveyed more closely what we do on this podcast. Isn't that right?
I think that would be true. Yeah, we were a bit more of a generalist podcast than when it comes to archaeology than we were when we first set out.
That's right. And the other thing that Emmanuel suggested, he was like, well, I've seen the budget because he knows what we pay him. And so the obvious thing to do would be to get a listener to send in a name and then we would just steal it.
That's correct.
But we told Emmanuel that we actually think about this less as a business transaction and more of a relationship with the listener.
That's true. We are reciprocal, you know?
Yeah. So
we are titled and titled by.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly right. And so in addition to being titled, entitled and titled by, we might need to be retitled. And we think because of the relationship we've entered into with the listener that we would have to compensate the listener in kind, and it's in kind for tax reasons.
Exactly. Yeah. We're a not-for-profit entity.
Yeah. And so Ken, if a listener were to write in with a new name for this podcast, where would they send it?
They would send that to newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. That's New Brunswick Archaeology, all one word. Archaeology spelled ARCHAEOLOGY. newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. And you can also send us a direct message on Instagram @new_brunswick_archaeology. And archaeology spelled the same way.
That's right. And so, Ken, as you can tell by the mortar fire in the background, I'm here in sunny Southern California, and the listener might have any number of guesses about why I'm here in Anaheim. I mean, I could have had a low draft number and had to be sent in. I could be here just to eat tacos. But actually, Ken, I'm here because Mrs. Dr. Reinick is attending the American Academy of Family Practice annual conference here in Anaheim. And that means, in a feeling that would be somewhat unfamiliar to most New Brunswickers or Albertans, I'm surrounded by roughly 8,000 family physicians. And Ken, one thing renaming this podcast won't do for our New Brunswick listeners is get them a primary care doctor. And we know this is a problem that affects about a quarter of New Brunswickers and nearly 40% of Fredericktonians. And Ken, I'm going to preface this by noting that I am a doctor, but I'm not the kind that helps people. And none of what I'm about to say should be construed as real medical advice. But I think the statistics are pretty clear that having a family doctor is crucial for peace of mind, preventative care, ensuring healthy obstetrical outcomes and not dying in an emergency room while stuffed in a storage closet while the attending physician rocks back and forth in the hallway screaming, "Why me, God?" and blood drips off the ceiling. Meanwhile, in your province, Ken, I understand that Tommy Douglas was recently hanged in effigy, and the UCP has released its rather terse statement on the doctor shortage, reminding the populace that if they want the same Botox Danielle Smith gets, it's readily available from numerous licensed providers at reasonable prices. And Ken, since I've been here at the AAFP meeting, I've put on my social scientist cap, well, brown fedora, and I've been meeting with some of the movers and shakers in the family medicine space, I believe they call it. And I believe the MBA's running American and Albertan hospitals would call it that, too. So I'm gonna lay out here kind of a scenario that's happened and then a solution that I've come to that is not only going to help our listeners, but is going to be lucrative. So in 2009, the U.S. government eliminated a program for medical education that was called the Fifth Pathway. That term, borrowed from Buddhism, I believe, referred to an approach to medical school education for Americans in which students could attend a foreign medical school, usually in Guadalajara, and then do a fifth year of clinical training in the U.S. and apply to Yankee residencies. This whole thing is outlined, of course, in the 1985 film Bad Medicine.
I think it's also outlined in Simpsons when Dr. Nick Riviera explains that he went to Hollywood Upstairs Medical College.
I think that might be true, yes. However, Ken, that program was discontinued in 2009, cutting off medical education to numerous prospective physicians. And that's no bueno, as they say, at the Universidad Autónoma Guadalajara. And well, the Americans still there mostly say no good because they were planning on finishing their training at the Jersey City Medical Center in Hackensack, which they will not be doing anymore. And well, Ken, other podcasters might have just suggested these guys consider Caribbean medical schools, right? The New Brunswick Archaeology podcast, however, sees opportunity. And is that opportunity to open a clinic in New Brunswick, you ask? No, Ken, that would be illegal. Alberta? No, Ken, no one wants to live in Alberta. No, that's right, Ken. I've cast my sights just a few hours south of where I am right now to Tijuana, where the NV Archaeology podcast has partnered with a small team of what would have been Fifth Pathway physicians to offer a medical practice catering to the specific demands of the Canadian consumer. And there's a substantial precedent for this, Ken. Border towns are littered with peso-on-the-barrel dental practices, and I suspect you and many of our listeners have seen headlines like, quote, "Kidnapped Americans were in Mexico for tummy tuck," end quote. And Ken, at this point, it's just a modest practice, and you'll of course recall the quote from Eddie and the Cruisers, "We can't be great, we're just a couple of guys from Jersey." Well, with a few GPs from Newark, Camden, Trent, and Asbury Park, each with a dream and a legal obligation to fulfill their practice commitment to the Mexican government, they can, and the NV Archaeology podcast is here to help them. The way we make this work, Ken, the financials, if you will, is just math, and that math is that one Mexican peso is worth 0.076 Canadian dollars, and it's only about a 22-hour flight from Fredericton to Tijuana, or 17 hours from Lethbridge. Now, that may seem like a lot, but that's a mere fraction of a New Brunswick or Lethbridge ER wait time. And you know what they have on those flights that they don't have at the Dex ER, Ken? Tequila. That's right, Ken. So not only are we offering cost and time-efficient primary care to the residents of each of our provinces, a full 10% of this practice's production rates, so you can kind of move the decimal around on this math here, comes back to us, Ken, and that's because we are angel investors who have staked as collateral this very podcast for them to buy their Tijuana office.
Yeah, and you know, folks, that is a significant investment in this prize read.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. It is. And we're expecting to profit heartily, but we want you to know it's because we're civic-minded is why we're doing
exactly. This. Exactly. It'll be redistributed.
Absolutely. Yeah. And Ken, the American audience may not be familiar with the practice model we're using, but it's called concierge medicine. I learned about it last night, actually, while touring around the book room here at the conference. And it's membership-based. And this affords the patient unparalleled access to their physician because the membership fee, again, of which the NB Archaeology podcast takes only a modest cut, permits our physicians to keep their patient panels quite low. And in return, you get 24/7 access to the physician at any hour of the day or night using a telehealth program or via an in-person visit, which, of course, for many listeners requires a flight, but that's totally worth it. And that's not all, Ken. Membership includes an annual executive physical, including a full range of preventive screening tests, cardiovascular counseling, travel medicine services, vaccinations, access to specialists at Hospital Angeles Tijuana, consultation with a longevity medicine coach, predictive genomics, acupuncture, and medical aesthetics. And Ken,
presumably these are all things that you saw in the book room last night.
They sure are, yeah. Ken. As they say, an ounce of prevention is worth a kilogram of cure. And that's why for the lucky listener who renames this podcast, they're getting a year's subscription to this innovative medical service and two free flights to get them started on their wellness journey. just south of here in Tawana. And Ken, where would the listener who successfully renames this podcast send in the new name for it?
Well, they would be sending that to newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. That's New Brunswick Archaeology, all one word, archaeology spelled archaeology. newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. And you can find us on Instagram at new_brunswick_archaeology. And archaeology spelled the same way.
That's right. And Ken, if you open that mailbag, what is inside of it?
Let me see here. Oh, and to update the listener, there is actually no Greenwich, New Brunswick, but there is both a Greenwich Hill in Kings County and a Greenwich Parish in Kings County.
Okay.
Yeah. If you had that's burning question stewing on the...
Some of our listeners just had to erase their email they were going to send in, correcting us
about the
name for that province. Yes. No erratum this year, this time.
So... No, we are currently empty on the in the mailbox. But one of the things that we do want to highlight is that although we don't have a mailbox, we now actually have a LinkedIn page.
That's right.
And a LinkedIn page that Gabe and I have recently been appointed super admins of, which is a position I've never held before, but I'm thoroughly excited for. And so, you know, at some point, maybe in our careers. We will both be super admins, Gabe.
Ken, I hope that's not the case. And but yes, it's possible. The way things are heading at my university, it might be a last man standing kind of situation.
Well, I was going to say, I think that part of it is that neither of us will actually be professors at any point in the future. We'll just everyone at the university will become some kind of admin.
Yes, that's right.
That's how universities work, isn't it?
I think it is. Yeah, I'm just waiting for the mandatory Lean Six Sigma training.
Yeah, exactly. So nothing in the mailbox, but Cody has been hard at work in the background getting some socials materials together. And you might start to see a little bit more content from the New Brunswick Archaeology podcast. And so we are happy to have you guys engaging, and we welcome emails, texts to the... Instagram, and now I guess you can follow us on LinkedIn, and we will follow you back to grow our network.
That's right. And by we mean Cody will follow you back, and he will relay any interesting messages up the chain to the super admins.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yes. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. The system works.
That's exactly right. And Ken, so we've got an exciting show for the listener. We're going to talk about the SAA's recent statement on deep testing, and we'll be talking with folks from the SAA Geoarchaeology Interest Group.
Yeah, so Heidi Luxinger and Carl Kibler are both consultants basically working in the CRM industry in the United States. Heidi and both geoarchaeologists basically with different backgrounds.
Yes.
And kind of share what their role was in developing the statement and also kind of their thoughts on deep testing and geoarchaeology more broadly. So this is not just about deep testing. We actually get talking into what geoarchaeology entails and what kind of training people have. And if you're a student, what kind of training you should be sussing out as part of your undergraduate and graduate training if you're really interested in geoarchaeology.
And don't worry, listener, if you just poured yourself another Courvoisier thinking Ken and I were about to describe geoarchaeology, we're not. We're going to let the guests do that.
Yeah. As I think we both admit, you like to say that rocks aren't real. I believe in the reality of rocks. I also don't believe, but not at this depth. No, this is where I know that my professional experience, has its limitations. So,
all right.
Yeah.
And so, with that, Ken, should we invite the listener to drill baby drill and we'll see him on the other side.
We'll see them on the other side of that deep, deep hole.
All right. Talk to you soon, listener. Today we're joined by the co-chairs of the Society for American Archaeology's Geoarchaeology Interest Group's Geoarchaeology Task Force to discuss that group's recent statement on deep testing for terrestrial sites and professional qualifications for geoarchaeologists in cultural resource management in the United States. Dr. Heidi Luxinger is the senior archaeologist and founder of Precision Geoarchaeology, Inc. and the global lead cultural heritage technical community and the geoarchaeology services lead at ERM. Educated at Barnard and Texas A&M, she's published extensively on geoarchaeology in such journals as Current Research in the Pleistocene and Quaternary International, and authored the entry for geoarchaeology in the Encyclopedia of Archaeology. She's authored numerous CRM reports and conducted archaeological, geoarchaeological, and micromorphological analysis. You can tell I'm not a geoarchaeologist as I stumble over micromorphological analysis on site-specific and regional projects in the United States, Argentina, and Ireland. Among her many awards, she was the recipient of the Douglas C. Kellogg Award for her research in northern Patagonia. Carl Kibler is the owner and consulting geoarchaeologist at Cross Timbers Geoarchaeological Services. He was educated at Miami University in Ohio and the University of Texas at Austin. He has over 35 years of experience conducting cultural resource management geoarchaeological research, including various geomorphic and depositional settings and environments, especially in Texas and Oklahoma. He's published numerous CRM books, book chapters, and articles in such journals as The Plains Anthropologist, Current Archaeological Research in Texas, and TIVA. In addition to interpreting soil stratigraphy, depositional and erosional histories, and soil histories, he's experienced working with granulometric, chemical, magnetic susceptibility, stable isotope, radiocarbon, and OSL datasets, and methodological expertise in electrical resistivity, GPR, and magnetometer surveys, most of which I know what they are. Thank you both very much for joining us. We're really excited to talk about the statement you headed the group that authored and share some stuff about deep testing with our listeners.
Thank you.
Heidi, and thanks, Carol, for coming on.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, and so we were chatting before we came on that this is probably going to be of interest to a lot of our listeners. We get a big Northeast audience, and deep testing has been a subject of some interest in, where Gabe is neck of the woods in sort of northern New England, and then also in New Brunswick specifically. So just to begin, some of our listeners are not professional archaeologists, so we wondered if you could begin by describing basically what geoarchaeology is and what kind of problems it seeks to address.
Well, to put it simply, geoarchaeology is the use of geosciences or earth science to address archaeological problems or archaeological issues. And what I mean by earth science or geosciences are things like sedimentology, stratigraphy, geochronology, soil science, geomorphology, the study of landforms and landscapes. And for me personally, it's the two major workhorses for me are soils and geomorphology, and how to look at landscapes and where on that landscape will you find sites that are deeply buried, where will you find them on the surface, and where you will find them shallowly buried. And, that variation dictates how we, look at that landscape and how and strategies we use to go and find archaeological sites.
That's a great description, Carl. And I'll just add one of the phrases I like to use in describing geoarchaeology is it's geoscience for the sake of archaeology and nothing more. To kind of define our scope is that we're here, we have the geoscience training, but we're only interested in what can help us understand the archaeology better. I have worked and studied with a lot of soil scientists and geomorphologists, and they're great, and they're great friends, but there's stuff that they explore and they're interested in that has nothing to do with archaeology. So when I was in grad school, I was taking classes along with them, but the whole time I was filtering out, okay, what do I really need to understand in order to help better understand the archaeological record? And one of the things I think geoarchaeology is such a powerful tool is that, in the U.S., at least I can speak for the U.S., in a lot of graduate programs, there isn't a lot of training in the geosciences in the archaeology programs. And therefore, sometimes you can go out into a landscape, if you don't understand it, it all looks the same. But in reality, with the background in pedology and geomorphology, you begin to understand as Carl has described it before, landscapes are a mosaic of landforms, and those landforms can be different ages. So if you're looking for a site that's buried from the Middle Holocene, well, you should go target the Middle Holocene landforms where those sites could be buried. So it helps us piece out high potential areas for finding buried archaeological sites, which are the ones that tend to be better preserved, of course, and then also determining the areas that have low potential for buried archaeological sites and kind of rule those out. So it's kind of, there's this perception, I think, sometimes that geoarchaeologists just make more work for us. Well, not really. We can actually cut it back. We can make projects more efficient. Carl and I are both in cultural resource management, and a lot of our work, it can actually be seen as risk reduction or risk management. We can detect those sites before a project goes to construction and then avoid the issue of discovering a site during construction, which can significantly delay the completion of a project, and no client wants to hear that, unfortunately, but it does happen.
Yeah. Yeah. So in like the scoping of a project, for example, like knowing those kinds of like what landforms, these high potential landforms, you know, you're talking to your clients, your proponents about like engineering design, right? Like maybe avoiding this knoll over here, rather, and you know, if you can site your road or your pipeline around that area, you could save, you know, time when it comes to the archaeology work.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of our projects, you know, pipelines and roads and bridges, they will cross, you know, high probability areas, you know, floodplains and terraces where things are deeply buried and or shallowly buried. And, you know, we can tell these folks that, well, you might want to, you know, route around this area because there is a potential for, you know, archaeology that is deeply buried there. And that's going to, you know, that's going to take some time to deal with if you decide to route your project.
I was going to say, I think both Carl and I have good examples that demonstrate the cost, the increase in costs that these unanticipated discoveries can cause. And that's how you can see it, look at it as in terms of risk reduction. I'll give my example first and then Carl can give his example. Very recently, just a couple of months ago, I was monitoring construction on a project north of here, and I discovered a very early archaeological site during just grading. And essentially, the client wanted to stay on schedule, so the client decided we're going to HDD, horizontal directional drilling, which means they drill underneath the site to avoid it. That costs about $1 million to drill one of those. So that was a significant increase in cost. Had that been delineated, we might have been able to work with engineers to avoid that site, but unfortunately that didn't happen. And Carl, you have a good example about construction equipment just sitting idle for months at a time.
Yeah, I was working on a project a few years ago where during construction an archaeological monitor noticed cultural materials coming out of the construction area, a dig site where they're putting in the footings for a bridge, and the entire construction project in that area got shut down for about 3 or 4 months while they dealt with this unexpected find. And I can remember the construction company foreman saying something about, well, you know, most of this heavy equipment out here is not ours. We're renting it, and it costs, you know, several thousand of dollars a day to rent it. And now it's just sitting idle. So all of that could have been avoided if the original survey had employed some deep testing methods and found this site years before the construction started. But unfortunately, there was no deep testing done. And lo and behold, during construction, a site is found and everything comes to a screeching halt.
That's right, listener. You heard it here first. It's not a question of whether you can afford geoarchaeology. It's whether a question of you can afford to not geoarchaeology. I think that's the moral here.
Thank you. That's a great way of putting it. Yeah, yeah, we are often brought in, you know, in an emergency. And we just think if you had just brought us in earlier, it, you know, we might not be in this situation. But again, you know, there's a little bit we can control these situations.
And so a lot of what you've talked about here, you mentioned you both work in CRM, a number of the other authors on this on the task force report work in CRM, and one of the things that you talk about in the report is the degree to which geoarchaeology is mandated, or really not mandated, in legislation in the United States. And we know that report is focusing on the United States, but we wonder if you could just discuss a little bit about how geoarchaeology is mandated, how it's understood as a profession, say, independent of other kinds of archaeological subspecialties.
Sure. I'll throw out some numbers first, as that kind of helps illustrate it, since we're on the air, and then Carl, add to it whatever you like. Based on a review of the guidelines or lack of guidelines throughout the U.S., state by state, went through all 50 states, we found, and we have a map in our statement that illustrates this, we found that a majority, 88%, 44 states, have little or limited or no guidance on deep testing, 88% of states. So it's not mandated in most cases. About 54%, 27 states, so half states, have absolutely no guidance about deep testing, and only about 34% or 17 states have limited guidelines on deep testing. So it's not mandated in most cases.
And just for the listener, what are we talking about when we're talking about the range of, like, when does deep testing begin? I guess at what depth are we talking about, like, when you're thinking about deep testing? So we're like, you know, I know in, so where New Brunswick, basically one of the examples is that, you know, you can't really easily dig a shovel test pit beyond about a meter to a meter 20, you know, and there's rules in the guidelines in New Brunswick. For example, if you have a series of test pits that go beyond or are clearly going to deeper than a meter 20, you have to open them up into a 1x1 excavation unit and then dig, you know, a sondage down in the corner. And then if you can't do that, you need to employ some kind of deep testing method. So like augering or something like that to determine where archaeological bottom might be. But what is the sort of the range of deep testing when we're thinking about it from kind of a regulatory standpoint?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, how deep is deep? Yeah. You know? Typically, when we use the term deep testing, we're talking about something more than a meter deep. So in the U.S., you know, we can typically dig a shovel test down to 80 centimeters, 100 centimeters. So anything below that depth would be what we would consider deep testing. Now, the other issue that comes into play here is the depth of impact of the pipeline or the bridge footings or, you know, whatever is being constructed, how deep are those impacts going to be? So if you're laying a pipeline across the floodplain at a depth of 4 meters, shovel testing will only get you so far. It'll test the upper meter of those deposits. And so what about the 3 meters below that, you know, between the terminal, the bottom of the shovel test, and the bottom impact associated with the pipeline? There's a gap there. We call that the testing gap in our statement. And so basically we need to find a way to test those deeper deposits, and that's basically what we refer to as deep testing.
Yeah, and so you bring up this testing gap, and so was this basically, like, what was the specific problem the Geoarchaeology Task Force were looking to address with the statement, and specifically about professional qualifications for geoarchaeologists, and kind of what do you guys envision, or what did the committee, the task force envision as kind of the gold standard of qualifications versus what should be considered like a minimum standard that you would think should be developed and kind of rolled out?
And just a minute, I want to add something to what Carl said, just to, if that's all right.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And that was in terms of, I think some people kind of have the perception that sediments, say in a river valley, are deposited at a really even rate everywhere. And so 50 years is 50 centimeters, 100 years is 100 centimeters. I'm just using a vague example here. In some cases, you may dig down 80 centimeters or a meter and get down to the depth of very young sediments and only get down to, say, 1953, okay? Or you could be digging down to 5,000 BP. It varies greatly. So you know, some people even say there's no point in shovel testing floodplains because you're going to dig through modern flood deposits. If you're looking especially for deeply buried or, you know, buried contact sites, we should start with, a colleague who says that, who's an archaeologist, we should start with the deep testing. So there is that variability, and it depends on the landform as well.
Terrific. And so actually, maybe just to follow up on this a little bit too, and we're cutting ahead a little bit, Ken, and I'm sorry, I've just preempted the question that you had, but since we're talking about techniques and deep testing here, I think for some of our listeners, they may not really be familiar with the techniques. Like, what do we mean when we're saying deep testing? We talked about deeper than a meter. What sort of equipment are we talking about? You know, what do you guys have a favorite auger? just kind of unpack what this means and what are sort of the range of techniques we're talking about here.
I'll start off and then Carl, you can.
The listener can't see this. They're both smiling. This is what they obviously want to talk about heavy equipment.
Of course, we really like our construction equipment, our heavy equipment. No, Carl and I have a friendly competition in terms of the equipment we use. Now it's all in fun. I tend to.
They're not smiling anymore, listener.
No, I tend to use a geoprobe, a soil probe. It's a hollow stem auger. Mechanical hydraulic powder auger, and I take sediment cores. I basically extract 5-foot tubes of sediments from the ground, and it can go to basically any depth for the most part, depending until you break the drill, essentially. And then I take so it's an intact core. It's about, they can be 2 to 3 centimeters in diameter or about 1.75 centimeters. I take those cores back to the lab, split them open them like a book. So I have, a nice clean profile. And use that for testing for the potential of buried surfaces, not necessarily sites. I can extract artifacts. I haven't extracted a lot other than modern things, but I have cored through ash layers and charcoal and things that are clearly cultural features. So I can detect things like that. And then the other method, and this is the one that both Carl and I use, is backhoe trenching. The advantage of backhoe trenching is that you can open up these nice wide profiles right there in the field. The advantage to coring is you could take the stratigraphy back to the lab, but it's you have to piece together the landscape, like a fence diagram. You have basically a column here and a column there and a column there. But Carl, you have done this a lot more than I have, so please feel free to add.
Yeah, like Heidi says, my preferred method is using a mechanical excavator, either a backhoe or a track hoe, and to open up a big window into the landform that we're looking at. And once the trench is open, you get down there and you look at the trench walls to see if there are artifacts in place. And after that, you record the stratigraphy, the soil stratigraphy, and from that you can start piecing together the geologic and soil history of your project area once you get enough of those profiles. And as a bonus, if you have money for radiocarbon dating, you can add some hard numbers to those deposits that you're looking at.
Yeah, and so we kind of Gabe joked about you can't afford not to have geoarchaeology out there, but it kind of sounds like though the idea with this, the techniques that you guys are using are to get out there right at the start of the project and like, let's understand what we're dealing with right now before we even go in and do things like conventional shovel testing, right? Like this is going to give us a much better understanding of how to deal with this landform rather than testing first and then having this, you'd mentioned the testing gap, and then having to go back and do another form of testing. So like rather than going over a landform twice, you can kind of get a sense of it right from the get-go through one of many different geotechnical techniques and then go from there.
It's good strategy. It is targeting the landforms that we really need to investigate and then not dismissing, but prioritizing those. That's what we really need to investigate. This is nothing against shovel testing. Shovel testing is a very effective survey technique, but it has its limits, and we have to recognize that. And I also like to follow up with what Carl said. Yes, we can radiocarbon date these sediments the most time. If there's any kind of, or if you get a really fine glade sediment, a nice clay, a nice gray clay, you can get pretty reliable radiocarbon dates, bulk samples. They are bulk samples, but hey, they give you a ballpark. Is this 14,000 years old? Is this 40,000 years old? Is this 4,000 years old? And at that depth, at that specific depth. So you really can reconstruct when and how these sediments were deposited all the way up the profile. So, and also we find charcoal in our cores or backhoe trenches. We find chunks of charcoal that we can, or pieces of wood, any organic matter that we can radiocarbon date as well. So we can get a real high resolution perspective or image of the landscape even before we go out and test. It's just not typically done that way. And that's one of the things is that we're advocating for is bring us in at the beginning, include us in the proposal from the very beginning. Let us just do a desktop and see do we even need to do deep testing? Do we need to do, or is this all weathered bedrock? You're not going to find much in weathered bedrock, maybe a few surface sites, but we can really refine, make it more efficient, make it more cost-effective, and reduce risk.
Yeah, and you guys are scoping, and that's like you talk about the radiocarbon date. So this is like right at the scoping stage. You're thinking about the, you know, the analysis that you can do on these, including getting dating right from the get-go. You know, I think when you're thinking about scoping some CRM work, you're not always thinking, because it's prospection, you're not thinking about things like radiocarbon dates right off the bat, because you're going out to determine a presence-absence exercise in most cases, right? Whereas you guys are scoping this, thinking about those radiocarbon dates not necessarily being a cultural episode, but being able to date the natural stratigraphy and the landscape itself.
Yes, because we're not doing the scoping most of the time. We scope our own work, but it's other people that are doing the scoping, and they're not thinking about bringing us in. And unfortunately, in the U.S., a lot of times it's because it's not required, and they can't convince a client that, well, this isn't required. Whereas we understand that, but you know, we're in business, and you know, if we're talking about efficiency and cost savings and risk reduction, those are the levers to pull. That's what we're trying to advocate for. Even though it's not required, it's a better idea, much better idea, because we're here to do better archaeology, just like everybody else.
That's great. And so, and just to follow up just briefly on the technique. So one of the things that I'm taking from both of the techniques that are sort of each of your pet techniques, you're emphasizing not so much finding artifacts as finding landforms that need to be explored further. Is that an accurate summary?
I would say that's accurate. I mean, you do have to remember that, you know, whether you dig a shovel test or a trench or you use a geoprobe, the reason you're out there is to look for archaeology. So there is this presence absence thing. The documentation of the stratigraphy is just adding a framework to it all so that we can make better decisions down the road and tailor our search strategies better. You know, let's not focus on an upland surface that has been deflated or has been stable for 20,000 years. Let's not ignore that, but let's not put a great effort into that. You know, let's put our efforts into places on the landscape where things are potentially deeply buried.
Yeah, it's positive bias, I guess, if you look at it that way. We're categorizing, you know, what's more important than what else. And I just, if I can just insert this here, both Carl and I are in CRM, but I am actually a former academic. I taught for 15 years at East Carolina University. And we run into, so I don't want to blame this all on CRM. It's an issue in academia as well. There's a lot of geoarchaeology that's not being done in academia. You see it when you go to the conferences and whatnot. So this is a push both in academia, academic archaeology, and CRM archaeology. I, in fact, have never taught a geoarchaeology class. And that's one of the reasons I left academia. I was like, what am I doing? You know, I'm teaching. I was a teaching faculty, teaching classes 12 months a year in intro classes. I wasn't teaching what I was trained to do. And so that's when I moved into CRM, I got a lot more respect and recognition for being a geoarchaeologist and seeing the value in what I can commit to or contribute to a project.
Let's dig into that a little bit, actually. One of the things that you all talk about in the statement is about the professional qualifications for a geoarchaeologist. You know, the listener will be surprised to hear it's as you alluded to, I think both of you, there's not really a geoarchaeology school. You know, it's not like you sign up for the geoarchaeology track. How do you, maybe tell us a little bit about each of your personal journeys into geoarchaeology and how one becomes a geoarchaeologist and what the minimum qualifications should be?
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's one of the really interesting things in putting this group of people together, so the 13 of us, last September, and we had to put it together pretty quickly. I was chair of Geoarchaeology Interest Group last year, and in the annual report, I requested to put together this task force. President called me up. He said, send me a list of names, get it on my desk by the beginning of March. And so I immediately contacted Carl, like, Carl, we're going to do this, and let's put some people together. And then in September, we started to meet. And honestly, at first, because geoarchaeologists, we work in such solitude, We were just, it was like group therapy. It's like, oh my gosh, I'm with my people. These are my people. And so we spent a lot of time talking about this, because what was interesting is we then realized we all have such different backgrounds, but we all arrived at the same place. And so writing that section on qualifications was difficult, because we're, you know, somebody'd be like, well, I wouldn't qualify for this, or I wouldn't. So we had, you know, we had a lot of great discussions about, okay, what do we really need? And I think two of the things that, as Carl mentioned earlier, is, or for any archaeologist to have at least a course in pedology and geomorphology, so you understand what is between bedrock and the surface soil, because that is, at least in North America, that is where the archaeological record is, between the surface and bedrock. But anyways, backing up just briefly, my background, I started out at Boston University working with the geoarchaeologist Paul Goldberg. That's how I got into micromorphology. I was working as the secretary of the English department at BU, going part-time, and it was boring beyond belief. I just answered phones. This was a while ago. And while I was doing that, I read Mike Waters' book, Principles of Geoarchaeology in North American Perspective, and I was just blown away. I had such a love for archaeology, but also had always had an affinity for geoscience, and I realized, oh my gosh, I could combine the two. And so I decided then and there, this is who I need to go study with. And so I applied, actually had a difficult time getting into graduate school because I was a classics major in college, not sure why, but it got me into archaeology. But I didn't have a degree in anthropology, but I was accepted. Mike accepted me, and I went to go work with him, and I did both my master's and PhD with him. However, as I mentioned before, my degrees, his approach was, you do all the archaeology and then you do all this extra training in the geosciences. I almost have enough training to have another master's in the geosciences. I just haven't done that formally, but so I was doing both at the same time. I did my master's at the Galt Clovis site in Central Texas. I did the micromorphology there. That's that background. Right. He wanted me to do a site-specific project for my thesis. And then I decided, I won a Fulbright and I got some NSF funding, and I went to Argentina and worked on reconstructing the geomorphology of the largest river in Northern Patagonia. I was working with the archaeologists down there. So that was my dissertation. And so that he wanted me to do a regional study, a landscape reconstruction for my dissertation. And then the rest is history. And Carl has a really interesting story, and it's very different from mine. But again, we really did, you know, all 13 of us really arrived at the same place as professional geoarchaeologists. That's why that was a difficult discussion. But go ahead, Carl.
Yeah, you know, no one in North America gets a bachelor's degree or a master's degree in geoarchaeology. There is no such degree. For myself, my degrees are in anthropology, and I minored in geology and geography, but I can think of a number of colleagues and other geoarchaeologists who came into geoarchaeology from the geosciences. A good friend of mine, Charles Frederick, his bachelor's degree is in geology, but his master's and PhD is in geography. Yet he and I are doing basically the same thing, geoarchaeology in CRM. So everyone comes in to geoarchaeology from a different place, and it's interesting because we all have different strengths and weaknesses, and it's interesting to say the least.
Yeah. I was going to say, it sounded like Heidi had developed an aversion to boredom was part of, it sounded like her career there was that might have been the spark of it. It sounds like you had a pretty interesting run here too, Carl.
So for the students, basically the takeaway is that if you're thinking about, you know, what's going to help like your round out your degree and your, you know, if you're interested in these kinds of things, it's to explore outside of your anthropology or archaeology department and be looking specifically for some of these undergraduate geology and geography courses that can inform, you know, a better understanding, like essentially you will understand your archaeology work just by understanding the landscape better.
Yeah. I mean, that's, start with the landscape. It will save you so much time.
And money, clients, money.
Yeah, we're exactly. Yeah. So one of the things we talked about before we started taping is that we've got a very good North American coverage here. So, you know, I'm Northern Plains, and Carl, you're Southern Plains, Southwest, and Heidi, you're in the Southeast. Gabe's in the far Northeast, and so we're massive geographies, very different. You know, part of the world was glaciated, part was not, and all these other things. And in the report, you discuss kind of this overdependence on archaeological predictive models based on GIS variables, right? And so we're in very different places. And so, you know, one of the things that can happen with some of these GIS-based predictive models is that they become very generalized, right? And so if, you know, if you're trying to think about where people were in the past, we've got four different areas of North America, but even, you know, a predictive model in different parts of the Carolinas, for example, you would need a predictive model for these different things. And so can you tell us a little bit about the problems with predictive modeling and how you guys envision that being addressed and how that ties in with this deep testing issue?
I'll start and then Carl can add to that. I think he knows why. I wrote that section of course, the input with everybody. It's one of my pet peeves. It's something that I'm trying hard to transform, because a lot of these, what I'm frustrated about is that a lot of these predictive models that I've seen and have actually had to correct for clients is they're based on soils data that is low resolution and sometimes flawed. And the reason for that is that data was not collected for the purposes of archaeology, which needs high resolution, localized, specific data. I've talked to soils, I have friends of soil scientists who've done that kind of testing out in the field, and they take cores at very wide intervals, and then they just sort of fill in, they connect the dots. But I've been in the field and I've looked at the soils data, and what I'm seeing in the field is very different than what was in the soils data. For example, I was working on a project in Virginia one time. I was able to cut out about a third of the testing for that client because the model the previous consultant had given them said it was all alluvium. And I went out to the field. I just did a quick recon. Like, this is not alluvium. This is gully bedrock, and I can prove it. This is not alluvium. We can do head survey and be done. The alluvium's over there. So I was able to cut back about a third of testing. There's just been a real heavy reliance on these predictive models. And I think it's because of the lack of geoarchaeology, the lack of understanding of how landscapes form. I was yesterday morning, I was doing an assessment of a project area, and I was looking at the soils data. And I do use soils data, and Carl does too, but we use it as a grain of salt. There was one description, because pedologists, they are just focused on the surface soil. They are not focused on, and they're not trained to understand a lot of the geomorphology. So they're just focused on the surface soil, which could be very recent. But I was reading this one soil description, and it said, well, these are formed on sediments that are either marine or fluvial. And I was like, I kind of need to know the difference. If it's marine, it's way too old. If it's fluvial, it could be Holocene, and you could have sites, and it's all fine deposits. So obviously that's something that I'm going to have to go, you know, do a field recon or ground truth it. I think that these models can be misleading, and they have been misleading, and they've led to mistakes, big mistakes. And this is, it's really not that we need to throw them out the window. We need to just change them, enhance them. It's one of the things I'm trying to do currently in my position, is add in the geomorphology to these models. Don't just base it on, well, slope, you exclude slope, usually greater than 15%. But we need to change the variables, and we need to be less reliant on the soils data. The soils data needs to be interpreted, not relied on.
So it's a resolution problem in part, or in large part, but also it sounds like a little bit of even an accuracy problem.
Accuracy.
Yeah, exactly.
And so from the soil side of things, is part of the like, maybe I'm wrong when I'm thinking about this, but a lot of that soil data would probably be to inform like where there's agriculturally viable areas. Would that sort of be a lot of what that pedological data that was collected would have been for?
Yeah, I mean, the soil descriptions are exhaustive. I mean, they gathered just a really impressive amount of information, and most of it we don't need. We're mostly looking for parent material, evidence of buried paleosols, you know, buried surfaces, you know, soil development may give us kind of a relative idea of how old a landform is. you know, we're interpreting that SOLAS data because we're actually reading through it because that's our training. But in the models that I've seen, that's not what people are doing. They're just pulling these geomorph descriptions that a pedologist may or may not have understood what they were talking about and relying on that. That's how it could be flawed.
Yeah, so it's basically having the training to know when the data that you're using for these predictive models is actually not right. It's like the
garbage. And you can't do that with AI yet.
it's a resolution problem. It's also a problem that the data you're using is from the current environment. And it says nothing really about the past environment. I mean, you know, rivers migrate laterally, and where that channel is today isn't where it was, you know, 1,000 years ago or 3,000 years ago.
And this, I guess, is another important reason for deep testing, is that you don't know what's below that initial chunk until you've done that. That makes a lot of sense. So we're mindful both of your time, and we appreciate you both coming on. This is all really, really interesting, and I think that our listeners are going to find this very, very useful. But what other initiatives are on the Geoarchaeology Task Force's plate? What's next in geoarchaeology?
Well, one of the things that the past president of SAA told me when he gave us the green light for the task force, he said, "It's great you asked for a task force." This is Dan Sandweiss. It's like, great you asked for a task force, because task force are easy to get approval for because they begin and they end quickly. And so our task force actually ended. It's not a committee. It's not an interest group. This is a task force. So officially it ended. We're all still friends, though. We officially ended at the annual meeting in.
And the listener can't see it. They have the t-shirts, too. That's the,
they'll have the.
It's actually the same gesture you use to operate a skid steer that's lowering a core into the.
matching tattoos and the whole thing. So we're formally not a task force any longer, but we still meet periodically. And I think at this point, it's about getting the word out. That's why we were so happy to be invited. We were invited to give a presentation yesterday at another organization. And it's just great to see so much interest. That's one of the reasons I'm on LinkedIn so much, is that so many people have reached out to me, and it's become a platform of where I can really get the word out, beat the drum. I think people are almost tired of it at this point in time, but I'm not going to give up, because it's too important. The archaeological record is too important to make mistakes, because it's non-renewable. So advocacy, more than anything, we've been talking about, reaching out to SHPAs directly, although our timing could not be worse, honestly, because of the things that are going on right now. And we fully recognize that. That's why we haven't started a huge campaign, because we just don't know what's going to happen. But on the other hand, we're not going to quit. We're not going to give up. And anybody that wants to talk to us, we're happy to talk.
Fantastic. And will you all be at the SAA? Is there an interest group people could join that's separate from the task force as well?
There is. There's the Geoarchaeological Interest Group, or GIG, which is a part of SAA. So I think it's open to anyone with an interest in geoarchaeology.
Excellent.
Part of your membership.
And the membership fee, I think, is all of $3 a year. So it's really expensive.
You really can't afford not to do geoarchaeology at that price.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think they tend to have a session, like kind of their own session, because I was in one a couple of years ago that was like sponsored by the geoarchaeology.
Yeah, we're going to have a panel called that's being organized by one of our task force members, Judy Joyce, who's with Eocene, and it's called Mind the Gap. And it's going to be a panel. It's going to be Carl. You're on that, aren't you? Are you? You're coming. You are. You decide to come.
Yes.
Yeah, we got Carl to come to San Francisco. So we're going to have a panel of, and I think it's mostly those that were on the task force that will be participating in this panel. We'll be continuing to talk about this. And I'm sorry if I can put a plug in for myself. I was recently asked by SAA to run for president, so I'll be running for president of SAA next year.
Fantastic.
Okay.
Yeah. Congratulations, condolences, whatever is appropriate, Heidi.
Thank you. No, I mean, whatever happens, happens. I'm just so honored to be asked.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. We spoke to Chris Doerr a few weeks ago, and we said, You really picked a great time to be the president of the SAA. That's an interesting a period of time to be the head of the organization.
But that's so great. And so again, listener, the statement is called "It's Society for American Archaeology Geoarchaeology Task Force Statement on Deep Testing for Terrestrial Sites and Professional Qualifications for Geoarchaeologists and Cultural Resources Management in the U.S. And we highly recommend that. And you'll find the author list there. It's available through the SAA website. If you just Google that, you'll find it. But we'll also put a link in the show notes.
Yes. So thank you, Carl. And thank you, Heidi.
Thank you both so much.
I really appreciate you guys coming
on. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Talk to you soon.
Well, Ken, I think it's time for Hit Pieces.
I think it is time for Hit Pieces.
And we've got a batch of local material, starting off with a new paper by Michelle Lilyev and colleagues.
Yeah, so we are taking a trip to the Chignecto Peninsula, and Michelle Lilyev and colleagues, Cynthia Martin, Mallory Corbett, Sarah Brooks, and Hannah Martin. Cynthia, Sarah, and Hannah are all Mi'kmaq community members, Mallory is the archaeologist for the Cape Breton Field Unit with Parks Canada. And they've been working on a collaborative project in the Chignecto Peninsula for a number of years. I'm sure we've probably reviewed at least one of their papers that's come out of this research group, basically. And so while the project, I think, from the outset sort of began as kind of a truly collaborative archaeology project, it's kind of evolved. And this paper in American Anthropologist is essentially kind of a bit of a narrative essay about the evolution of the research program over the last few years, and how there, even for a researcher like Michelle, who, you know, I think engages with Indigenous archaeology and collaborative archaeologies more generally, and has for a number of years, the way that they are doing archaeology is changing, right? And so, you know, within Indigenous and collaborative archaeologies, you know, there's a quote in here that, in general, community members and archaeologists believe that archaeology's land-based and embodied practices promote connections between relations, place, the past, and the future, connections that are necessary for healing the trauma caused by centuries of disconnection. And so they draw on the importance for Mi'kmaq community members to be involved in archaeology work, to being out on the land and actually just engaging with the landscape and the places where artifacts are coming from. But they're also talking about the way that they've approached field work and how that's shifted. So there's this kind of interesting discussion about how where they were going to place excavation units shifted because one of the women on the crew made noted that there was a traditional plant that could be gathered, and if it was damaged, if you just strip the sods off and dig in that location, it could ruin the it could destroy the plant. And so they, in one case, they dug up the plants and moved them and repositioned them while they were doing their excavation work. In another, they sort of moved the ferns aside to minimize the kind of damage that they were doing to that landscape. And it's tying into the Mi'kmaq's connection to the land itself, right? And how archaeology and ancestors are, you know, there in the landscape. And for community members, getting back to that has been really important. So it's kind of interesting for anybody who's doing collaborative research to see a program that's sort of at its maturity and is really, we're seeing the archaeology itself changing rather than just writing about what we hope we can do in Indigenous archaeology.
And we should say this builds on a fair bit of work that Michelle's done in that region, and including a book that is quite good called Unsettling Mobility.
Yeah, that I think both of us quite like. So
yeah, very good book. And also, if you're a graduate student looking to kind of think through how to potentially use theory to do to think about settlement and subsistence, in particular, you know, among Northeast groups, that's a great place to start.
Yeah. There's a great chapter on Mi'kmaq Catholicism that's actually, I think that I've assigned just as a standalone chapter, just because it's so, it's such an interesting history and intersection with archaeology and the way people practice, right?
Absolutely, yeah. No, good stuff. Great to see coming out. The listeners knows we're kind of working through a nice summer's backlog. So that was, kind of in front of me, Michelle's paper's from a few months ago, I think, right?
Let's see here. So it came out, So it came out in January, or it was accepted in January. So I don't know. specifically when it hit the web, but it is still listed, at least in the version that I have, as a pre-issue publication. So the DOI isn't tied to an issue yet. So it's I'm guessing it's in the forthcoming issue of the American Anthropologist. So, and then the other paper is from a group of authors who we are familiar with, at least three of whom have been on the podcast, including our co-host, Dr. Gabriel Reinick, Arthur Anderson, Caitlin DeWater, and then William Kaczynski and Arthur Spies, who is the William Kaczynski is at the University of New England in the School of Marine and Environmental Programs. And we'll remember Caitlin DeWater was on a little while ago talking about a previous paper that you guys had in Journal of Island.
Journal of North American Archaeologist.
North American Archaeologist.
And she is now, I believe, a graduate student at the University of Miami.
Oh, and that one is in Ohio.
So I'm realizing I'm not actually sure about this, Ken, because she studies coral reefs. So it might
a Miami university in on the coast. Yeah.
She might actually just be in Miami.
Yeah. Yeah. Not a whole lot of coral reef in Ohio.
Yes. So I apologize, Katie, if we've missed that.
Yeah. And then Arthur Spies is the director of the Maine. Is it director? Is that his title?
Senior archaeologist.
Senior archaeologist with the Maine Historic Preservation Commission. And so,
so
the paper is called Characterizing the Erosion of Coastal Archaeological Sites on the Maritime Peninsula Using Survey, Collection, Analysis, Excavation, and Modeling. It's in the most recent, it's in the pre-publication or whatever it's called, early release or online first or whatever.
First view.
First view, okay. American Antiquity, which for the list.
Ken, I'm surprised you don't know that it's called First View because I would have assumed you were checking to see when your Advances in Archaeology practice paper was up near daily.
I think, though, it's called something different for AAP, but I.
Oh, yeah. Is it?
Anyway. It is out now, listener. You can find it. And Gabe, I don't know, is it open access?
It is open access to the generous UNB Library has some sort of arrangement with Cambridge Publishing.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
That we get basically gratis open access, which we appreciate.
That's fantastic.
From them.
So
yes.
So Gabe, what's the paper about?
Yes. Well, so Ken, that's funny. Someone at the airport the other day actually asked me what I do. And I said, well, most recently what I've been doing is telling people that the archaeological record on the coast is totally, and then I used an expletive. And what we did, and I should say that
a horn sound there or something, you know.
Yes, yes. And in addition to the authors there, I should say a lot of this work is derived from some survey that Matt Betts was very involved in as well. And what we did was we went out and we surveyed in Maine and Nova Scotia a bunch of archaeological sites that had first been reported in mostly in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And we compared the condition of the sites back then to the condition in which we find them now. And basically, even though erosion was already a problem in the 50s, it's the sites that were still there and retained research potential back then are in large part gone. They've been eroded due to the increase in coastal erosion. So that was the first thing we did. That's pretty ominous. And then we looked at one particular landform at Sip Bay, and we compared the collection that Ted Stoddard had accumulated from that site in the 50s to compare what he'd been finding at that site compared to what we find at the site. And we argue that what Ted was finding was substantially older. So he was finding stuff just artifacts from, say, the Archaic and the early woodland, whereas we pretty much only know that landform from our work as a middle woodland and late woodland site. And so basically.
And so for the listener, where is sort of the archaeological record truncated, is the term you guys use, like the in time, yep, time reference?
Exactly. So you've got this real problem.
2200 years ago, sort of thing, right? Yeah.
Oh, yes, exactly. Yep. So you've got this real problem that not only are a huge number of the sites destroyed, the stuff that we're actually able to excavate is much more recent than the stuff that people were able to excavate in the past. And then finally what we did, and this is a lot of what Will and Katie do, we used LIDAR and various sea level rise scenarios to think about, of the few remaining sites, how doomed are they? And the answer is very. And we argue that the take-home point from this is that there's actually basically very little point in doing archaeological survey on the coast anymore and instead almost all efforts should be focused towards prioritization and mitigation. You know, it's not like, and one of the things we note in there is it's not like we were finding new sites during our surveys. And when we did find a new site, it was almost always reported by a concerned local.
Right. And so you're the prioritizing excavation and essentially recovering what information we can learn about the sort of narrow window of the past that kind of remains intact.
Yeah, that's right.
Excellent.
And also, but I mean, just to be aware too, that, that the nature of the record here is such too, that, I mean, even historic resources are threatened. It's going to keep getting worse. It's pretty bleak.
Yeah. Folks, it's not just New Orleans that's sinking. If you don't want to swim, might as well pick up a trowel.
Exactly. Yeah. That's right. I think, Ken, yes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's great.
Yeah. Thank you.
For the listener too, American Antiquity is essentially the premier journal in archaeology in North America, and so this is really fantastic to see not only Gabe and Arthur and dear friends appearing in the journal, but also highlighting the region in a really top-notch journal and with high visibility too, which is great.
Well, thanks, Ken. I appreciate that. I'm glad that we're gonna have you in another one of the SAA journals soon. And if we can come up with something to put in Latin American Antiquity, maybe we can hit for the triple crown.
This is it. Well, this is why we need that research program in Barbuda. So that's
yes. Well, this is why we're also going to be operating out of the out of that medical clinic we're opening in Tijuana.
Exactly. That would be the best place to position things. Yeah.
Exactly.
I've got a colleague who works in Oaxaca, and so maybe we could just hop on with Jay and head down there.
Yeah, I mean, how hard can it be to learn a new language, culture,
exactly.
Region, colleagues? Yeah,
exactly.
But I'm willing
especially
to try.
If the margaritas.
I think we should give it a whirl.
So, I assume they're top notch.
Which I assume they are. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're pretty good.
Well,
and I'm just in
so
Anaheim
this is the thing
right now,
is so we usually talk about food. You must be having some fantastic Mexican food.
So Ken, I don't know if you know very much about Anaheim, but we're going to have fantastic Mexican food once the conference is over and we get out of Anaheim. Anaheim is sort of a conference hell. It's a kind of conference hellscape. It's sort of like if like Reston, Virginia, is to Washington D.C., it's kind of what Anaheim is to. Is to Los Angeles, but with the added complication that it seems to exist to support, I'm going to screw this up, if it's Disneyland or Disney World,
Disneyland.
One of the Disney things.
Yeah.
Yes.
My memory of Anaheim was that it was 105 degrees Fahrenheit while we were there, and we had to leave Disneyland, you know, at around like 12:30 every day, in part because it was so hot that it was just like we needed to go to an air-conditioned place and relax for a bit. And I don't know if this is just like a memory that I've made up in my mind, but I distinctly remember somebody had fried an egg in the parking lot. So I'll have to ask my parents if that's a real memory or if that's something that got mixed up with cartoons that I was watching. I remember a very busy street and walking down to Disneyland, leaving for the afternoon for a siesta, and then coming back to that light parade thing that doesn't happen anymore. But there's an excellent Indiana Jones ride there. So if you and Nadine have a chance to duck away to Disneyland, you can take in the Indiana Jones thrill ride.
Yes, I've always thought my motion sickness would respond very well to that activity. I'll take that under advisement, Ken. But no, I suspect, I'll have some food recommendations once we've, because we're headed out to Joshua Tree once the conference is over for the weekend.
Into the wilds of an unmaintained and unrangered national park.
Absolutely. the other thing I'm curious about is it's possible the next time the listener hears from me, I'll still be here because I understand that there's major flight slowdowns anticipated on account of the government shutdown.
That's
so
good.
My semester may be taking place from Anaheim. But,
well, there could be worse places to be.
We've all got our little crosses to bear, and if mine has to be that I spend the fall in Southern California, I guess. I guess that's what it has to be.
Just take it on the nose. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. All right, listener. Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you as always. I'm going to go back to being a war correspondent here, and I think Ken is going to go back to the picket line.
No, not picket line.
The daycare.
Yes, the daycare. They're teachers. Actually, they're not even picketing. There's some reason why they're not allowed to picket. The teachers aren't. So they are on strike,
really?
And they've been locked out. But my understanding is that they're not picketing.
Okay. Yeah. That sounds like that must be a strange technicality.
So labor relations in Alberta are strange in general.
Yeah.
You can imagine, can't imagine why.
I know. That's right, listener. You heard it here first. Buy gold.
Bitcoin.
Exactly.
There's our new sponsor. We said Bitcoin. So they're, now.
Absolutely.
Brought to you by crypto. Okay.
Precisely right. On that happy note, Ken, perhaps we should let the listener go.
Yeah. They can soak in the rays, and Gabe, make sure you put that helmet back on and be safe, soldier.
All right. Talk to you soon, Ken.
Talk to you soon, listener.
See you, listener.